I'm going to start asking all of you to dig up papers, because it's really lame for me to like draw data up here. So, because there's great data coming out. So maybe I'll just tell you a few things that I kind of want you to look up. I have time to. Okay, so some of this undoubtedly you've seen before, but I just want to refresh everybody's memory. All right, so for quite a while now, we've had pretty firm evidence that there's something other than the luminous stuff that we see in galaxies, right? And the way we know this is like a saga that people have heard now for a long, long time. At this point, you know, I heard this story since I was, you know, a little kid, and it's more or less been steady for decades now. But when you look at stars in galaxies and you look at their velocities, if you just had some core, right, some core of high mass, you would expect the velocity profile as a function of the radius from the center to go something like square root of the mass enclosed in that center over r, right? But in fact, you know, this is not what we see. We don't see this. What we find is we find velocity profiles that are basically constant out to the largest scales that we can actually measure these velocities in galaxies, right? And so this suggests that there's a component. And you know, a component roughly with some profile like 1 over r squared, essentially so that the mass enclosed in this region of size r grows with r linearly, and so you expect a constant velocity profile. Right. So that picture has been with us for a long time. Actually, if you look at these so-called rotation curves, from one galaxy to the next, they're remarkably stable and consistent with one another, flat out to very large radius. So that's certainly very, you know, it's indirect. Well, I don't know one should call this direct or indirect, but it's pretty solid evidence that there's a missing component that we can just see gravitationally. Okay, and if you just follow this line of reasoning, you get an estimate that roughly 10% of the universe is made out of this stuff. Okay, you can do the same thing with galaxy clusters, and then you can also look at specific instances. Probably the best instance of this is the bullet cluster, where essentially two galaxies pass right through one another, and two things were true of this process. It really looked like whatever dark matter was in these galaxies more or less didn't interact, okay, but the gases got stripped out from the tidal forces of the dark matter, and that you can see very clearly. So at this point, it's pretty compelling that there's some missing component that we're just not seeing. I mean, the other possibility is that maybe we don't understand gravity correctly. Maybe gravity is modified compared to what we think. But I think the consensus in the scientific community at this point is that there is dark matter, and it's probably made out of particles. Now, it looks like the mass, the bulk of the mass has just gone in a ballistic trajectory, mm-hmm. whereas the gas has got tidally stripped out. If the dark matter interacted, you'd expect to see a whole clump of junk right in the middle, you know, like it would have gotten tangled up. That didn't seem to happen. I'm just qualitatively. I mean, there's a long literature on this, on the bullet cluster. I have the number if you want. 1E0657-558. So you can read. There's a long literature on that particular bullet cluster. Okay. Now, more recently, within the, what is it called? It's called the concordance model. So at least within our modern picture of cosmology, we include floating fractions of baryonic, cold, non-interacting dark matter, dark energy, and then we use direct and indirect methods to constrain these fractions. So probably the most precise measurement to date of dark matter is from measurements of the cosmic microwave background, and essentially these measurements use the impact that dark matter has in the early universe and the behavior of the acoustic peaks in the CMB. So the precise location of the acoustic peaks in the CMB gives you a measure of the dark matter fraction. And so this is probably the best measurement to date. So this is, we'll call it non-baryonic matter. So this fraction, I could put an equal sign here, 0.110 plus or minus 0.006. There's always this h squared because Hubble is not measured precisely. Okay. All right. So now that's the fraction of the universe that appears to be comprised of dark matter. Now locally, we can perform the same kind of peculiar velocity measurements and get an estimate of the local density of dark matter. So the local density, I'm not going to quote it relative to the critical density, because that's just silly. We're going to talk about local densities. But so this is about 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter. So that's roughly our estimate of how much dark matter there is locally. Now, okay, this number just sort of presumes that dark matter is more or less smooth, that it's made up of microscopic particles. It's like a gas, and we're living in it. But at least early on, one very popular idea, and there were a series of searches to look for these objects, is that the dark matter was comprised of non-luminous, kind of heavy, compact objects. And so there were a number of surveys to try to find these objects, and essentially what you would do is you would, if you have a compact heavy object moving through a system, then the stars in the line of sight between, well, sorry, if this object passes through the line of sight between you and the stars you're looking at, these objects could gravitationally lens the stars. So there were a number of lensing surveys that didn't find noticeable signals. And that set an upper bound on the fraction of the dark matter that could be, I mean, roughly it set an upper bound on the fraction of the dark matter that could be in kind of big non-luminous compact objects. And it's still the case that big non-luminous compact objects could carry a reasonable fraction of the dark matter, but by no means all of it. Okay. Now there's sources within the standard model of non-baryonic matter that we wouldn't see. So what's that? I mean, there are neutrinos, right? So there's neutrinos. They don't interact so strongly with us. We learned that a while ago. As I said, at typical energies in the universe, neutrinos have a mean free path in even water that's on the order of the scale of galaxies. Okay, so they really don't interact with us. They don't interact with each other very well either. Okay, but that fraction, based on what we know of the three light neutrino species and constraints on their mass and also calculations of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, we have a pretty good idea that the fraction in the form of known neutrinos, h squared, is less than, it's a small number. I'm going to say that. It's tiny. So that, we don't think that accounts for the dark matter. It didn't have to be that way. Heavy neutrinos could have accounted for the dark matter, and in particular, if there's new generations, if there's a fourth generation, or if you have vector-like matter beyond the standard model, the corresponding electromagnetic singlets that you typically get whenever you have things that are charged under the SU2 weak interactions, all objects like that are reasonable dark matter candidates if they're stable. Okay. Now, for quite a while, actually, just the idea that there's a heavy neutrino and that can account for dark matter was quite popular. But as you'll see, most of those ideas don't work when you look at direct detection constraints. So we'll get there in just a second. Now, there's also axions. Okay, so I don't know. Did you talk about axions in either Michael's course or Veronica's course? In cosmology. Oh, okay. Yeah.
When you say heavy neutrino, do you mean an entirely new species or a heavy ripening neutrino?
I mean an entire, I mean it could be either one. So it depends on, it could be either an entire new generation of particles charged under 3-2-1 gauge interactions. In other words, you could have a new doublet, and the electromagnetic singlet in that doublet could be dark matter. That would be just like one of our neutrinos, left-handed neutrino. Or you could have a right-handed state. Either one. Either one would be an okay, would be a valid candidate. Well, it's an overstatement to say right-handed ones don't work. Right-handed ones can work. Left-handed ones are hard because they couple in a spin-independent fashion to nuclei. Okay, and you'll see the limits are pretty strong for that. Okay, so what did you learn about axions? Because I don't want to rehash axions, but so axions were introduced to solve the strong CP problem, right? Did you learn that? I'll tell you the word story because this would take us a little bit far afield. Within QCD, you can write down the following term in the Lagrangian. So this is totally a tangent, but I just want to make sure you know this story. So there's a term in the Lagrangian. That looks like this. Okay? So G is the field strength of the gluon fields. G dual, or G tilde, this is just G contracted with an epsilon tensor. So G tilde mu nu is basically it's epsilon mu nu rho sigma, G rho sigma. Okay? And these have opposite CP properties that compared to G. So G tilde transforms oppositely under CP compared to G. Okay, so there's a term you can write down. It's dimension 4. It survives to low energy. It's consistent with all the symmetries of the standard model. And it violates CP. All right. Now remember that very early on, it appeared that the strong interactions did not violate CP. Okay, this is like starting from the 50s and 60s, it was quite clear that the strong interactions did not violate parity, not violate CP, like preserve these interactions, preserve those symmetries extremely well. Okay, which would mean that this term has to be extremely small. And actually, at this point, this coupling parameter for this term in the standard model needs to be less than something on the order of 10 to the minus 10. So just tiny, tiny, tiny.
What
you can measure EDMs. I think EDM, electric dipole moment measurements, give you the strongest constraint on these operators at this point. Okay. But to make a long story short, the question is, why is a term that, in principle, you could write down, because this is what the known symmetries of the standard model, so small? That's the strong CP problem. Okay, and one possibility, at least in the early days, was that if one of the quark masses was light, you could actually rotate this term away. Sorry, if one of the quark masses was zero, you could rotate this term away. But that doesn't appear to be true anymore. Yeah?
I know this is a tangential, but can you write, like,
For the one F zero.
Okay. What about SE2? I'm not that worried about
it. So with SU2, right, I'm just trying to remember the argument. Whenever you write terms like this down, this is not like an invariant. So you're allowed to rotate. You're allowed to rotate the quarks, right? And when you rotate the there's axial currents, then there's the vector currents. And when you rotate, there's an axial rotation of the quarks that gives rise to the axial current, and there's a vector-like rotation of the quarks that gives rise to the vector current. The axial rotation of the quarks does not leave terms like this invariant. Okay, those rotations don't preserve CP. So I believe the answer is that for the weak interactions, you can rotate those terms away. They're not independent. Okay, you can't rotate away all sources of CP violation in the weak interactions. But for example, in QCD, if you write this term down, you can rotate this term away, but it'll show up as a phase in the mass matrix or in the axial part of the couplings of the core current. Okay, so you can't get rid of the phase, but you can move it around. Okay. There's a more sophisticated way of saying how you keep track of the physical CP violating phase, but it's not fresh in my memory, and it would take us a little bit far afield. So we could talk about Jarl-Skog invariants, for example, which is a sort of nice compact way of keeping track of the physical phases. Okay. Now, axions. Okay, so the way that you solve this problem, one way of solving this problem, is to introduce a dynamical field that can essentially cancel this term off just through dynamics. So essentially, the way it works is you have a U1 Pesci-Quinn symmetry. I'm just telling you words now. There's a pseudoscalar associated with that symmetry. Instanton effects give rise to a potential for the axion field, which is the pseudoscalar associated with the spontaneous breaking of that symmetry. And then that potential allows the axion field to relax to a point where it very nearly cancels off theta, because that's the point of lowest energy. Okay, so there's a dynamical mechanism that you can invoke to make the effective theta term tiny. But then the prediction you get out of that is that you should have pseudoscalar states that couple very weakly to the standard model. There's a relationship between their coupling and their mass, and they would be extremely long-lived or stable. They could be extremely long-lived or stable, especially if they're lighter than everything else in the standard model. Okay. So that was another candidate of dark matter, and that's not ruled out. Axions could be dark matter. Okay. I'm not going to go through calculations of their relic abundance. But this is a possibility that's been with us for decades now. It's very hard to test because axions interact with us through dimension 5 operators, so they're suppressed at low energies. So right now, probably the best experiment out there, probably the only hope for detecting axions, if axions are dark matter, is by using an experiment called ADMX. And I think right now that experiment's at the University of Washington. And essentially what ADMX does, there's an axion gamma vertex. This vertex is suppressed by a mass scale called F. This is known as the axion decay constant. Okay, and essentially what this experiment does is it has a high Q electromagnetic cavity. And so what it tries to do is it tries to convert axions, if they're dark matter, into photons in this cavity, and then it looks for the photon signal. Okay. So the only thing I want you to really remember from this is that ADMX is the experiment that has a good shot of testing the possibility that axions are dark matter. Okay. By far the most popular hypothesis is that dark matter is made up of what are known as WIMPs. Okay. So I just told you about machos or compact objects. I told you about axions. But WIMPs are really the thing that most people think will, at the end of the day, constitute dark matter. WIMP stands for weakly interacting massive particle. Okay? I think you know this. I'm not going to write it down. Did you talk about WIMPs in Veronica's course? Okay. Michael's course? Okay. WIMPs are really simple, so it's not like there's anything.
We did talk about it.
We did way more of it.
Yeah.
The first time.
Yeah. All right. So, okay. So, I don't want to tell this historically. I just want to try to summarize why people care so much about WIMPs. Okay. So, first, let me just give you sort of the bottom-up argument. It's kind of interesting. So dark matter is roughly, 25% of the mass density, or it's, you know, 0.1 if you divided by h squared if you measure relative to the critical density. So how do you get that abundance of dark matter? I mean, if you have a stable particle, where does this energy density come from? Okay. So the important thing you need to know is that any time you have a stable particle species that's thermalized in the early universe, you're going to end up with some original abundance of that species if it's stable. All right. So essentially the way this works, I mean, this is just trivial dynamics, but I'll just sketch it out. Right? If you have a gas of particles at high temperature, high meaning temperature is much larger than the mass, then you basically, it's like a relativistic species, has an energy density that scales like temperature to the fourth. Okay? If these particles have interactions both with other species and themselves, they can stay in thermal equilibrium. So then as you cool the system, when the temperature goes through the mass of those particles, the density becomes Boltzmann suppressed, right? The density starts to drop, the number density starts to drop. And it becomes hard for these particles to stay in thermal equilibrium. Why? There's the difference between kinetic equilibrium and thermodynamic equilibrium. For them to stay in complete thermodynamic equilibrium, these particles have to be able to scatter off themselves. But if the density is getting small, eventually it's going to be the time scale for actually finding another particle, another dark matter particle. You know, if you're a dark matter particle and you ask, what's the time scale for finding another one? It's going to become comparable to the age of the universe at some point. Okay, and when that happens, basically these particles stop scattering off each other, they can't annihilate anymore, and they decouple from themselves. Now, they'll continue to scatter off of light relativistic species, so they'll stay in kinetic equilibrium. But they will stop annihilating. Okay? So how does this? So there's a simple way to just sketch out this calculation. Right? So you have some gas of, you know, dark matter particles in the early universe. So what's the rate of annihilation of a dark matter particle? Right? I mean, these particles stay in chemical equilibrium by annihilating and by pair creating through interactions. So if you just imagine, you know, take one dark matter particle and ask, what's its rate for scattering? It's going to be number density times the dark matter state times cross-section times velocity, right? This is the rate for scattering off the other dark matter states. Now, in practice, you want to thermally average this, all right, because it's not monochromatic, it's not at one energy. There's some Boltzmann distribution for the states. And that gives you some thermally averaged cross-section. And then you want to compare this to what? Right? This gives you a rate. But at what point do you expect decoupling to happen? You expect decoupling to happen when the rate for this becomes less than the rate for the expansion of the universe. Okay? So it's Hubble. So Hubble goes like square root of potential energy over M Planck. I'm going to use just squiggly signs all over the place and drop factors of pi and 2 and all that, okay? So basically, decoupling occurs when n sigma v is of order h. All right, well, what's useful to keep track of is not number density, but it's the number density per unit co-moving entropy. Okay, which is called little s. Little s is just the entropy of the relativistic degrees of freedom, or actually the entropy of the entire gas of states in the early universe. So usually what we do is we take n over s sigma v. We want to figure out at what point is it equal to Hubble over s, which we'll call, I'm going to say this is in radiation domination. So in radiation domination, v, the energy density, goes like number of degrees of freedom times t to the fourth. For relativistic species, I think there's a factor of pi squared over 30, but okay, we'll drop that. Okay, so this is going to go like square root g star, where g star counts the number of degrees of freedom. And then if this is t to the fourth, so I have a t squared here, over M Planck entropy. Entropy goes like g star. We call it g star sub s because the effective number of degrees of freedom that control entropy could be different than the effective number of degrees of freedom that controls energy density. But to a good approximation, they're equal. But this scales like g star t cubed. Okay. So I'm just going to call this g star t cubed. Right. So this whole thing scales like 1 over m Planck t square root g star. All right. This we give a name. This has a name. We call these y. So in this case, it's dark matter. All right. So you expect decoupling to occur. So decoupling. Let's call it freeze out. That's what it's called. This happens when y dark matter is of order. And I'm just going to bring sigma v on the other side. Sigma v m Planck temperature at freeze out square root g star. Okay. So this is a small number. Freeze out, remember when freeze out's going to happen. Freeze out's going to happen when these timescales become comparable, but that's not going to happen typically until the temperature is of order of the mass of the state under consideration, right? Because what's going to happen is this cross section is going to get Boltzmann suppressed. And that's going to happen when the temperature is of order of the mass. And in practice, it's not right at the dark matter mass. It's a factor of 10 or 20 below. Okay. So this gives you a scale for the number density per unit comoving entropy. And from this, you can calculate a critical density. And what people find, and this is sort of the important, this is the numerology that has had people fascinated for decades now, is that if sigma, dark matter, is something like, say, alpha 2 squared over m weak squared, so this is the cross-section you'd expect for particles that are weakly interacting. If this is the case, then what should we call this? Let's call this chi. This is our dark matter candidate. Okay. Then sigma chi is approximately the measured value of sigma dark matter. Okay. So this is called the Wimp miracle. I hate this name. Because it's not. I suppose it's. There's two reasons. First of all, if you do this carefully, it doesn't really work. I mean, it sort of works at the order of magnitude level, and I don't think you should call things that work at the order of magnitude level a miracle. But anyway, and it's basically true. Anytime you have a weakly coupled state underneath 100 TeV, you parametrically get dark matter that's sort of within a couple orders of magnitude of what we observe. Okay. So for this reason, you can use particles charged under SU2 near the weak scale that are stable. They will give you a thermal abundance, right? So what did we just calculate? We've calculated the sort of residual leftover junk that you've got that can't self-annihilate as the universe is expanding, okay? And what we're saying here is that if it's got roughly weak interactions, you get roughly the right abundance. But it doesn't have to be exactly weak interactions. It could just be weakly coupled in general. And you move the mass around a little bit, and that would also be a viable dark matter candidate. They are all often colloquially called WIMPs. Okay, some people use the term in the very strict sense, meaning charged under SU2 at the weak scale. Other people are a little bit, use it in the sense that I just described, weakly interacting in any of any kind. Okay. Okay, so this was only schematic, but this is by far the most popular hypothesis for what dark matter is. So this picture of dark matter would have dark matter as a gas of particles weakly interacting. Now, if these are the cross-sections for annihilation, it also means that the cross-sections for dark matter on dark matter scattering will also be tiny, right? So this would also naturally account for the self-interactions of dark matter being small, which is consistent with observation. Yeah? This is the entropy density. Which I defined over here in a really awful chalkboard fashion.
And then chi is just what we're calling
our name. Chi is the name I gave to a dark matter candidate.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't want to call it deep anyway. Yeah. Okay, I could be more precise about this. Let me just give you one formula that might be worth remembering. More precisely, sigma chi h squared is roughly 0.1 picobarns times speed of light over the annihilation cross section times V here, thermal average annihilation cross section times V. Okay. So if you have some dark matter, if you have some model that has a stable species, you can calculate the annihilation cross section, plug it into this formula, and get a sort of crude estimate for the thermal relic density. All right, so that you should just sort of log this away somewhere in your brain. It's a simple enough formula that it's quite useful. That's more or less just carrying this calculation, keeping track of all the factors, and doing, you know, being a little bit more careful. All right, so what kinds of WIP candidates do we have in beyond the standard model physics or in physics in general? We have many of them. So everybody knows in supersymmetry what the WIMP candidate is, right? It's the LSP, or the lightest stable particle. Okay, so this is the other way of motivating why the WIMP paradigm is so popular. It's not just that when you postulate the existence of a stable particle that's weakly interacting, you sort of roughly get the right thermal abundance. That's not the only reason. I think the real reason, in part, is that in probably the most popular theory of, that explains the gauge hierarchy problem, supersymmetry, early on, a parity called R-parity was introduced to explain why the proton's long-lived. Okay? And when you do that, you sort of get for free that the lightest supersymmetric partner in the spectrum is going to be stable. So if the lightest supersymmetric particle in the spectrum is weakly interacting, then it's a good dark matter candidate. Okay. Now that last step's actually important. It's not like given, it's not a given that the lightest, that the LSP is weakly interacting. Okay. In most of the theories that people like to think about, the lightest particle is weakly interacting because we imagine that the theory is that supersymmetry breaking occurs at a very high scale, and then as you run down, renormalization lifts the masses of the strongly interacting particles more than it does the weakly interacting particles. And that's just because the couplings, I mean, morally it's because the couplings are stronger. Okay? There's alpha S corrections that drag everything up that's strongly interacting. They also drag up the weakly interacting states, but not as much. Okay? So if you have this picture of the world where you have very high scale Suzy breaking and a lot of log running, and it's sort of a minimal setup, you would sort of generically expect the strongly interacting states to be heavy and the weakly interacting states to be lighter. So that puts you right into the corner of parameter space where the LSP is a good dark matter candidate. Okay, now in detail, actually getting the right, parametrically right dark matter abundance out of supersymmetric theories is not trivial. There's a few pockets of parameter space that work parametrically. Typically, what you get is, so for example, if the LSP is the partner of the photon, also known as the Beano, some people call it the Fotino, some people call it the Beanie, but anyway, I don't know. In that case, the annihilation cross section is actually, this is what I mean by if you work it out in detail, you don't quite get the right answer that you would like. The interaction cross-section is sufficiently large. I mean, it's still weak, but it's sufficiently large that to get the right abundance, you actually have to have a Beano sort of at several hundred GeV. You have to make it a little bit heavy. Okay. Sorry. I misspoke. Early on, sorry, I'm trying to tell this story a little bit historically. Early on, neutrinos were a very popular candidate. Okay. And this in part had to do with the theories of supersymmetry breaking that were being considered. So neutrinos, right, they're the supersymmetric particle of neutrinos. Remember how neutrinos are a perfectly reasonable dark matter candidate if they're heavy? Well, a neutrino is basically like a heavy neutrino. It's just a scalar, not a fermion. So it's like a great candidate for a dark matter. Okay, but those cross-sections, right, those really are like alpha 2 squared over m weak squared cross-sections. And so if you actually want to get the right abundance, you actually have to have a neutrino at several hundred GeV. That's a little heavy if you want to imagine that supersymmetry is solving the hierarchy problem. Okay. So that, and also at this point, there's, I'll come to it, but direct detection constraints more or less kill those scenarios. So then you can have a Beano. The Beano has the problem that you need to, well, I'm not sure if I want to actually discuss all the pockets of parameter space that that give you viable dark matter. But you have to invoke co-annihilation if you want a Beano to work. And if the LSP has a little bit of Higgsino or Wino content, Wino is the partner of the W, Higgsino is the partner of the Higgs, that more or less works. So you can get dark matter abundances in the right range in all of those pockets. Okay. There's other theories. There's little Higgs theories. There's UED theories. Anytime you have a theory for beyond the standard model physics that has a parity, you typically get a dark matter candidate. Okay. So dark matter candidates of this form, of the form of weakly interacting particles, are abound in particle theory. So I think that's the real reason why they're so darn popular, is that they're so darn easy to come up with. Okay. And they also sort of naturally explain why dark matter doesn't self-interact so largely. Okay, there's other possibilities. So primordial black holes used to be, an interesting hypothesis. So those would still be microscopic, but they'd be, they'd have these microscopic black holes floating around. They have a long lifetime because Hawking evaporation is parametrically slow if the black hole is just a little bit heavy. We're not talking about solar mass black holes. We're talking about tiny black holes, much, much, much smaller. All right. Now, I want to talk a little bit about searches for dark matter. I think that's a very, very lively field. Okay, so I printed out a bunch of papers mainly because, and this is the sign of a healthy field. If you can't remember the names of all the experiments, that usually means the experimental program is healthy. I can't remember the names of all the experiments. So let me try to give you just a summary, though, of the experimental program. I have my crib sheet here to... Okay. Everybody knows how direct detection works. I mean, you have a gas of dark matter, that's the hypothesis, and you want to see if it's there, so you sort of do the obvious thing, right? You take a chunk of material, you put it somewhere with low background, and you look to see if these dark matter particles can scatter off the material. Right? Okay. It's a simple, simple idea. It's a pain to actually implement. Because if you take these weak cross sections that you would expect on the basis of getting the right thermal abundance, and you turn those into direct detection rates, they're also tiny, tiny. Okay? So, typical event rates are like one event per day per kilogram of material. Okay? And that's on the high end. So imagine taking a kilogram of material and looking for some sort of signature that looks like a nucleus recoiling at the level of one event per day in a kilogram of material. I mean, so a kilogram of material has how many nuclei of order an Avogadro's number? And what substance on Earth doesn't have radioactive decay? Tell me that. Nothing. So I mean, everything is you take a gram of material and it's usually pretty active. I mean, if you're looking for nuclear recoils, you'll find them. You just get rare isotopes decaying. You also get, you're also being bombarded by cosmic rays. You have nearby material that's also radioactive, and in its decay, you get secondary scattering. So it's hard to do these experiments. It's easy to state the concept. It's much harder to actually pull off in practice. Okay, but okay, while I'm talking through this, I want to actually have you pull up a few papers, though. Just want to, you got your computers with you. All right. I think, as many of you know, the Xenon 100 collaboration put out a result this last week. Okay. So if you, I would like everybody to have that paper on there. Just download that paper and have it ready. So that paper, you can, there's several ways you can find it. You can Google search 100 live days Xenon 100, and that'll pull up a link to the archive. All right, the title of the paper is Dark Matter Results from 100 Live Days of Xenon 100 Data. And this is basically state of the art. Okay, this is where our field is at right now. I think this paper nicely summarizes it. It's not totally fair. I'm being recorded, so I should say it's not totally fair. There's other experiments that are. Have you found it yet? Yes? No? Okay. Great. All right. Now, so have this have that paper available. Now, there's another. There are two other papers that I want you to try to find. And I think I only decided this at the last second, so I apologize. I don't have an archive link. But has everybody? Okay, I'm sure the answer is yes. Everybody's heard of the DAMA collaboration, right? DAMA. Okay. They are now quite infamous. If you, I'm just going to put up the reference. All right, so I want you to find the Xenon 100 papers. So this is what I want you to find. I want you to find, DAMA. This is a journal link. You're probably not going to be able to download this. I'm not sure if you automatically have access to journal or not. Means and ways. Okay.
They should all have access to the University of Waterloo.
Yeah, you should have the University of Waterloo.
Okay. So this is a European physics journal. Do they actually get the... Okay, we're gonna adopt another means. Just Google search for like DAMA physics results. Okay. You want to look for the DAMA Libra.
Combined
results
from DAMA.
Anything? Sorry. You're looking for this. The DAMA Libra results that are from that are the latest ones. I think there's 2009 and 10 results, but look for the latest combined results between DAMA and the DAMA and the Libra means. Well, there are several years that they put out results. If they've got 2010 results out, which they do, and you see that, grab that one. New results from Demon Libra, that looks promising. 2010, awesome. Okay, and then the other experimental paper I want you just to pull up is anything from Kojin. I have to get their capitalization right. They have a funny cap. Now, I'm not trying to draw your attention to the anomalies, just because I think the anomalies are correct. But I'm going to ask you later on what you think of these. I think it's actually it might be capital G, capital N, T. I don't know. I don't remember exactly what the cap convention is. It's called coding. Okay, now just pull up the latest physics result from that collaboration. That's their cap convention. Cogen.
It's lowercase.
Huh? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, it is lowercase. Yeah. Well, okay. All right.
Germanium.
Yep.
Why?
All right. Now, yeah, that's why she's in there. But okay. Now, while you're grabbing physics results from these collaborations, and these collaborations have really been let me not say anything about them yet. There's two types of dark matter nuclear interactions that you have to think about when thinking about constraints. Nobody's reported a significant, I can't say that. Some people have reported dark matter observations. It's far from conclusive. But let's talk about how you look for dark matter in direct detection experiments. Okay. So we're in a halo of dark matter. That's the picture. We're traveling at roughly 200 kilometers a second, maybe a little faster. Okay, so there's some flux of dark matter particles on us. We can calculate that. And the dark matter can either scatter in a spin-independent way. So in other words, it can just couple to it can couple to essentially a nuclear number. And if it's coherent, it's nuclear number squared. Okay. Or if it's a Majorana particle, for example, it won't couple to this in a spin-independent fashion to the nucleus. It'll scatter in a spin-dependent fashion. It'll couple to the spin of the nucleus. Okay. I'm not sure if for Thursday we'll assign problems to calculate some of these cross sections. I just want to tell you the word story so that you have a kind of clear picture for what the categories of direct detection are. Okay, so anytime something couples to the Z boson and scatters that way, that's the case for particles that are charged under SU2, right? If you have a particle that's charged under SU2 and it can scatter through the Z off of a nucleus, right? This is basically a spin-independent. Well, it has a spin-dependent component. But this gives rise to spin-independent scattering. And there are the strongest constraints on dark matter scattering are of the spin-independent variety. So essentially, you get big nuclei, like xenon. You can use iodine. You can use germanium. All of these are good targets that have big, sizable spin-independent scattering cross sections for dark matter, just because there's a lot of nucleons. Okay, and so that's where you'll see the strongest constraints on dark matter scattering cross sections coming from. And that's so xenon 100, for example, sets right now the world's strongest constraint on spin-independent couplings of dark matter. I'll get to that in a second. But for example, you could have something where instead of scattering through the Z, you scatter, say, through a Higgs-like state. Okay. Or you can scatter through axial couplings that involve a vector, and that'll couple to spin and not nucleon number. Okay. Okay. So both these and axial couplings this family gives rise to. These scatterings give rise to spin-dependent scattering cross sections. Okay. And I think we will assign just a couple of toy calculations to illustrate kind of when you have a spin-independent and when you have spin-dependent. But to make kind of a long story short, if you have a particle that couples to the Z, you typically get a spin-independent scattering cross section between dark matter and nuclei. If it only couples to the Higgs, you can usually it's spin-dependent scattering that you have to worry about. The spin-independent rates are tiny, tiny, tiny. They're not outside of the realm of sensitivity of the existing experiments, but they're only maybe an order of magnitude outside. So upcoming experiments will see them, but in general, you have to worry a little bit less. Okay. So germanium and xenon are very popular targets for spin-independent searches, and then there's a whole host of other material with large spins, basically nuclei that have big spins. Those are what people use for spin-dependent searches, okay? And those include things like fluorine, sodium, germanium is also reasonable, iodine, xenon's not so bad, cesium, etc. Okay? Now I can talk, there's a long, long, long list of experiments performing searches. When you look at a dark matter experiment, the first question you should ask is, what energy range are they looking at? Okay, I told you that dark matter particles, if they're virialized with us, so if everything has roughly virial velocities in the galaxy, you expect that dark matter particles should have a velocity of order 200 to 300 kilometers per second. So roughly 10^-3 times the speed of light. Okay, so dark matter velocities units of speed of light should be of order 10^-3. Okay, so. This tells you something about nuclear recoil energies if a dark matter particle scatters elastically off a nucleus, right? I mean, first of all, this tells you that the energy of these dark matter particles, right? I mean, it's going to be of order what? The mass of the dark matter times beta squared right? So it's 10 to the minus 6 times the mass of the dark matter. So if the mass of the dark matter is, say, 100 GeV, let's just put in a number here. So this is 100 GeV. This would be 10 to the minus 4 GeV. So that's what, 100 keV? I'm doing my math right? Yeah. So that's maybe 100 keV for MDM of 100 GeV. Okay. But this is only going to give you a decent measurement of the scattering of the recoil energy if the dark matter particle is scattering off of a nucleus of comparable mass. Okay. Right, you know, just in 2-to-2 scattering, if you try to take a heavy particle and you scatter it off a light particle, the recoil energy drops way below the incoming energy of the particle. Right, if you want maximal energy transfer, you want to scatter off something of comparable mass. They're assuming something at the weak scale. Yeah. So that's why. So it's not. It's sort of twofold. It's to get a large cross section for spin independent couplings, and it's also to maximize the kinematic impact of the recoil. It's both reasons. Okay. But if for example the mass is much smaller, if the mass is a GeV, this is like keV. Okay. It's a small recoil energy. So you always want to ask the question, what nuclear recoil energy are these experiments sensitive to? In experiments like in the germanium experiment, well, I'm running out of time, so I'll just try to summarize this and we can come back to the results next time. I also want you to find the latest results from CDMS. Okay? So CDMS and COGEN are essentially glorified semiconductors that are modified to look for dark matter scattering. And they're germanium-based devices, and essentially what they do is they measure phonons in the material and they measure ionization energy in the material. And so anytime you have a dark matter scattering, that gives rise to a distinctive ionization and phonon signature, whereas a lot of the backgrounds give rise to phonon and ionization signatures that look different. So they actively reject background events. Okay, they have backgrounds, they reject those backgrounds, and then they look for things that look like dark matter nuclear recoils. Both COGEN and CDMS do this. Xenon-100 doesn't have phonons. They measure scintillation energy and ionization energy from scattering, and that's how they tell the difference between backgrounds and nuclear recoils. DAMA has a different strategy. They don't reject anything. They just take advantage of the fact that in the summer months, the Earth is headed into the dark matter wind, and in the winter months, the Earth is headed away from the dark matter wind, right? There's basically the flux of dark matter changes in the summer months from the winter months. So what they look for is not like, they don't try to like identify the exact events that are dark matter scattering events. They actually look at their overall rate and they look to see if it modulates, going from summer to winter, summer to winter. Yeah.
How do they know when it's moving in and out? Like, how do they know that about the dark matter, that the wind is going in a certain direction?
That's an educated guess. We don't know, right? Because we have not like, but it's based on the following hypothesis, which is that we think it's reasonable to assume that the dark matter halo is virialized with us, okay? So that the typical dispersion velocities of the dark matter particles are of order a couple hundred kilometers per second. Okay, so there's some like ambient background. We don't know exactly what it is, but whatever it is, we do know that with respect to that halo, the Earth is increasing its velocity and decreasing its velocity with the summer and winter relative to whatever that background halo is. So independent of the details of the halo, we know that the flux should increase and decrease, unless we're living in a stream, right? It could be the case that the dark matter is actually streaming on us and it's not a halo, and that would change this picture. So it's totally relying on the assumption that it's basically a halo, a gas that we're living in, which is, it's a reasonable assumption, I think. Okay, so they look for a signature of annual modulation, and they have a whopping 8 sigma signal, okay? And they've had this for a while now. Okay? It's very controversial. We can talk about it later. COGENT reports some anomalous events with their active background rejection strategy. Okay. CDMS, okay, or whatever, they have two events, but it's not a lot. And then you've got Xenon 100 that comes along, and they've got essentially nothing. All right. So we can talk about these experiments and what we think of them and what some of the shortcomings of the different experiments are and what some of the complementary strengths are. But to make a long story short, we're in a bit of a confused state right now. The latest and greatest experiment has found nothing. Okay. Other experiments, some of which have been around for quite a while, are reporting signals. There is an experiment that that I think has a chance of coming close to repeating. There's an experiment called KIMS, which uses a very similar target material and a very similar strategy in Korea, and they could conceivably cross-check Dama Libra pretty soon. I mean, rather directly cross-check Dama Libra. What the Dama Libra people say about all these other experiments is that all these other experiments actively reject events. And so how do you know that whatever they're seeing would show up here? Okay, that's what they've said for a long, long time. And actually, there are theories of dark matter where that actually at least a year or two ago did a very nice job of explaining Dama in a way that was consistent with all the constraints. And I can briefly summarize what that is, but actually Xenon 100 just put out a paper killing that idea. So that's one more paper I want you to have on your laptop for next time, which is Implications on Inelastic Dark Matter from 100 Live Days of Xenon 100. Now, I skipped over some of the signatures, like the energy signatures, like what does the recoil energy profile look like for dark matter scattering? That's because I want to do a calculation on the board, and we're running out of time. So I'll do that at the beginning of lecture next time. And then if you'd like to, we can talk about what some of these results are. And what I'd like to find out from you is what you think of these results. And I'd really like all of you to tell me why Dama has this signal and that at this point Xenon 100 seems to rule out. I mean, maybe their data is just wrong. But so between now and tomorrow, my request is look at the Xenon 100, 100 live days result. Look at the Dama Libra paper. I want to, in case you have trouble finding the sort of plot that indicates what their signal is, basically they. In their annual modulation, they have something that looks like that. It's this big hump, okay? You'll see plots in that paper that indicate that look like that. And it's basically the 2 to 6 keV region. So take a look at Dama, take a look at Cogent. And next time we can talk about what all of this might mean. I don't have the answer. So feel free to come and tell me what you think is wrong with one or all of these experiments. Because I'll tell you about some of the ideas that have been proposed over the last couple of years to explain them. Okay, I think we should probably stop there for today. Does anybody